Hi, I'm Janie Reisner, and welcome once again to Women's Voices.
Thank you.
You've been listening to It's Time to Wake Up from my CD, Okwaka Speaks, The Words and Music of Mother God. Joan Kerensky has been an advocate on behalf of women's rights throughout her career. She has led several national and local non-government organizations and has consulted on an international level in Russia, which we'll talk about, the NIS, the European Union, and Southeast Asia. She served as executive director of Wider Opportunities for Women, WOW, between 2001 and 2011. Established in 1964, WOW works nationally on a state level and is in its home community of Washington, D.C., to achieve economic independence for women and girls throughout their lifetime. WOW places a special emphasis on job training, including non-traditional occupations, education, access to necessary public benefits, and the use of specially designed family budgets to determine the real and specific costs of economic security for families of all sizes on a state-by-state basis and nationally. Between 1987 and 1994, Ms. Kerensky was executive director of the Older Women's League, OWL. OWL, a national advocacy and membership organization with chapters throughout the country that addresses economic and social issues facing women as they age. She was the co-founder and chair of the Campaign for Women's Health between 1991 and 1994 that provided a woman's voice in national health reform. Ms. Kerensky has worked in the field of violence against women since 1978. She was the first president of My Sister's Place in Washington, D.C., served as the executive director of Women Against Abuse, WAA, in Philadelphia between 1981 and 1987. Under her leadership, WAA successfully advocated for the first specialized civil and criminal courts in the country, created the first program for battered women in prison, as well as directed a comprehensive service program including a legal center, emergency shelter, transitional housing program for women charged with violence against their abusers, and a multi-million-dollar public education and prevention campaign. In 1991, she directed the first technical assistance office established by the U.S. Justice Department to implement the landmark Violence Against Women Act in all 50 states and the territories. Ms. Kerensky has testified before administrative hearings and Congress, made numerous television and radio appearances, and has been a resource to the written and electric media, federal agencies, and the White House. Today, Joan serves on various local, national, and international boards, including the Alliance for Girls, the Center on Women's Policy Studies, the Caring Economy, which is Rhian Eisler's work, Move the Mountain, the International Council of the New Israel Fund, the Center for National Security Studies, and the Income Security Committee of the National Academy of Social Insurance, where she serves as a fellow. Joan Kerensky has received a number of awards, including the Gloria Steinem Award, where she was named a Woman of Vision by the Ms. Foundation. Between 1995 and 2001, Ms. Kerensky was appointed by President Clinton to serve on the National Advisory Council on Violence Against Women. Welcome to Women's Voices, Joan.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
Thank you. You have been a busy woman. Well, you can't deny that. The first question I ask my guests is what part did your mother play in your becoming the productive and successful woman that you are today?
Well, I think I developed strength and visions of my future through both my mother and father. And as I think about how to differentiate the two, because they were always so closely aligned. I think the best way to describe it is that my mother helped build some of my internal strength, while my dad helped provide a role model for me in my external life. And as I thought about the question, Janie, that I knew you would be asking, I wanted to try to put my answer in more concrete terms. So you've given me something to think about, really. And mm-hmm. I think what I can say in terms of the impact of my mother on my life is that she taught me the ways of making peace with myself and in the world. She had she was a person who lived her life with a certain grace and a sense of humor that I have found very helpful. And most important, she helped me believe in myself and in the value of all who were around us. So I think that those are the primary attributes that have inspired me from being the daughter of Isabel Arthur Curry Anske.
That's lovely. That serves you well. Well, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Connecticut, and probably more important than that, I grew up in the late 60s and early 70s in terms of my most impressionistic years. I was lucky enough to be born and experience some of the very important movements of the 60s, the civil rights movement being one, moving on to the peace movement, which was the most active movement during my college years, and from that a growth into an understanding and appreciation of where women were in both of these earlier progressive movements, were or were not in leadership positions, and ultimately became engaged with the women's movement. So not so much my life in Connecticut, I think, that led me to what became my career, but really growing up during these times where you enjoyed Peter, Paul, and Mary and Bob Dylan at the same time that you enjoyed the Beatles and the Temptations and the Four Seasons, to give you some music analogies, because I know how much you enjoy music.
Right, right. Well, I'm a bit older. I'm a bit older than you, but I certainly fell in love with Peter, Paul, and Mary as well, and many of those. So your activism was born in college then?
Yeah, I certainly was involved in community activities. I worked with children who had severe learning disabilities when I was a kid. I volunteered at a camp for several summers to support activities for low-income kids. But those, I would all say, were more part of a kind of a do-good mentality, which I think I was imbued with in part, having seen my family be so involved in the community. But moving from do-good to activism to advocating for real change in how our systems and sometimes our government work was developed through my college years. Uh-huh. In fact, when I was in college, I had initially assumed that I would go into social work. But after a field internship in the social work department of a state mental institution, it became clear to me that I would be very frustrated with having to deal with the consequences of poor policies rather than trying to change those policies.
Wow. That was an important observation.
And it was all fun. I mean, I loved all the work I did. I've been committed to enhancing the role of women in our society as well as around the world, but it's all out of a sense of excitement. It happens to be what I find stimulating. It's not something that I would suggest came from a do-gooder attitude. Uh-huh. It happens to be what I enjoy doing.
that's wonderful. You are also a lawyer.
I am. I have practiced really only a small time in my career, and during that period, I worked several times with government, the Justice Department, the Federal Trade Commission, but mostly the work I did was in the field of what we would call public interest. I worked at legal services for several years. I worked with a small civil rights law firm. But I think of myself as a lawyer in remission. I really haven't practiced for many years, although I think particularly as my work has related to trying to affect legislative change, my legal education has come in handy, as it has with various debates I find myself in with folks who may disagree with the values or options that I have promoted, whether it is on a televised debate or otherwise.
Well, I would think it comes in handy, your background, wherever you are and what you're doing.
Well, I chose to get a degree in law after having had several early experiences that suggested that in the early to mid-70s, if you wanted to have a career and treat it with respect as a woman, it was very helpful to have a law degree.
Yeah.
One of those experiences was when I was a Nader's Raider, working for Ralph Nader one summer on a project called the Congress Project in D.C., where the Nader's Raiders were developing profiles on members of Congress. And, of course, I was interested in the few women who were in Congress, so two of my reports were on women, one Shirley Chisholm, a very dynamic African-American woman who was the first African-American woman to run for president, and the other was Louise Day Hicks, who was a Boston segregationist, to say the least. I observed while I was doing these interviews and on the Hill a lot that there were no women in responsible positions, and on the Hill there were no leaders of committees, there were no legislative aides who had responsibility who were women, and I began to recognize that a degree in law it was a good first step to being taken seriously, and I did have the opportunity. I had some male lawyers in my family, so I knew the legal system, but I did not initially think I would go into it. But ultimately, I chose to get a law degree so I could do the kinds of things I've done since then and overcome an initial hurdle that women faced in those days.
Yes, I can believe that. I can believe how hard and difficult it was for women then. It still really is, of course, but much has changed. Could you talk about your successful work for Women Against Abuse and this landmark Violence Against Women Act that happened in all 50 states and the territories? That's a wonderful accomplishment.
Yeah, I think the Battered Women's Movement is probably one of the most successful movements within the movements that women have in the last 20, 30 years brought to the attention of the American public. And 30 years ago, there wasn't even really a term in terms of around domestic violence, and there were very few places that women could go for help, or even were at the point of acknowledging what was happening to them as violence. Since then, there have been tremendous changes. It is still true that millions of women are battered each year or suffer some kind of sexual trauma, but there have been great, great changes made. My first experiences in the field, really, was as a volunteer in Washington, D.C., in helping to create the first battered women's shelter there. And in those days, the addresses of the shelters were confidential. You would meet women on the street in the hopes that she was not being followed. You found that many times women had tried other alternatives first, were very reluctant often to leave an abusive partner because they were concerned about the welfare of their children and that they would be separated from their from their kids if they tried to protect themselves from abuse. In the later 80s, Republican administration, there was a very important state of activities that held through the Attorney General's office a variety of hearings around the country on what was called family violence. And the thousands and thousands of women that came forward in those hearings, as well as hearing the challenges from law enforcement and trying to address some of these issues, was quite remarkable. And ultimately, almost 20 years later, you saw the emergence of the Violence Against Women Act. And the Violence Against Women Act was passed in 1994, and its purpose to this day is to encourage a comprehensive response to addressing violence in a local community or on the state level that makes clear both the important role of the legal community, lawyers, prosecutors, aides, advocates, and the nonprofit world where you have the advocates from the various battered women's shelters and local training programs, et cetera. And what has been revolutionary about this legislation is that you see, and then California is a good example of this, you see some change in how domestic violence is recognized, the numbers of programs that are in place, whether they're shelters or clinics or other kinds of direct services for battered women, as well as how the courts and the police and the prosecutors are handling these cases, especially in regard to holding batterers accountable. And there have been some statistics that suggest that there's been a significant decrease in certain crimes. However, as one crime begins to get over, under control, you see others, particularly around sexual assault. And, of course, we've heard a lot recently about sexual assault in the military, but I hasten to add that it's not only in the military where you see real challenges for women, but really in the larger society. And some of our studies are, within the movement and CDC, the Center for Disease Control, suggests that 1 in 3 women will have had experience either domestic violence or sexual abuse in the course of their lifetime in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. I want to interrupt and say you are listening to Joan Kerensky, an advocate on behalf of women's rights throughout her career and throughout her life. Yes, that's a sad commentary on life in this country and certainly in others as well. you were also the executive director of the Older Women's League, OWL. And our own community has a large population of older women. Could you talk about that work? And is it, what was it, and is it going on now?
Yes, well, I'm particularly happy to talk about this while I'm in California, because the Older Women's League began in Oakland. It was the vision of two women, Tish Summers and Lori Shields, one of whom has been a homemaker and most of her life, and as she aged and tried to get access to certain kinds of health care, pensions, she found that there were real disadvantages to being a woman, and she became an activist because of that. Tish Summers, on the other hand, had always been an activist. She'd been a peace activist, civil rights activist, and as she aged, she began to see the kind of discrimination or the results of discrimination in toward women throughout their lives, resulting in some pretty horrible statistics. And they include that women are poorer than men in their old age. They're likely to live longer but have less access to the kind of health care that's most responsive to their needs. And so those three factors, living longer, living more likely in poverty, and living in sickness, motivated Tish and Lori to establish the Older Women's League. Today, OWL still exists, and in fact, I believe there are still some vibrant chapters in California, and it addresses a number of issues. Both they can be around economic security in terms of looking at how women fare in the workplace as they get older, looking at how to minimize discrimination that can be discrimination against women or women and women of color and older women, seeing how the intersection of those things are and advocating for change to remediate that kind of discrimination. Two issues around retirement security, pensions and Social Security, which I'm happy to talk about in more depth, as well as health care decisions around throughout their life, but including decisions about how to die in control of your life, be in control for the end of life.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly older women, as we get older, and many women don't have as much money as men, and many are dependent upon Social Security, and as we watch everything cost more, food, housing, all of it, it's difficult. It's difficult for anyone who doesn't have very much money, and it's, I think, particularly difficult for women.
Well, it's particularly difficult for several reasons. One, they often outlive their partner or spouse, so they may not have the same kind of support, whether it's financial, physical, or emotional. And as they outlive that support, the value of their pensions or Social Security can become less, depending on the larger economic system and whether we there are cost of living increases adequate to the real needs that older people face. Most women don't have long-term care other than through being Medicaid eligible, which means you have to spend down to poverty to get any kind of real long-term care. So there are a lot of ways that women in the process of their health care are really cut short.
You think there are still chapters in California?
Yes.
Is there one in our community, I wonder? I suppose you could go online and find out.
Yeah, well, there is something, OWL California, and within that, there are several different chapters. There is one I know that still exists in San Francisco and one in Sacramento, and you can either call 916-444-2526 or email owlcap, owlcap, at gmail.com for the Sacramento one, and for San Francisco, I think if you go online and look at owlinfo at owlsf.org or call 415-989-4422, you will reach OWL San Francisco. And I think they have an upcoming meeting, actually, on pedestrian safety. So I urge people to go on the OWL website, either for the San Francisco or Sacramento chapters, or OWL California.
Mm-hmm. So that's OWL.
Yeah. And I should say that for many years, the OWL Sacramento chapter was very active in the Silver-Haired Legislature, which is a part of the California State Legislature, and really played a big role in building opportunities for older women in state policy. Today, another organization that I'm aware of, which was part of our WOW network, is a program for seniors that is focused on building economic opportunities. And that program can be located through an NGO called Insight, INSIGHT.
Uh-huh. Huh. So what help could one expect to find contacting one, any of these groups?
Well, I think with both OWL and Insight, there would be opportunities to, A, learn about what the profile of older women is in California. It would be an opportunity to connect with other resources who may offer you answers to questions that you have, whether depending on whether they're healthcare related or employment related or retirement income related. And then importantly, through the OWL chapters, you can be a voice on behalf of midlife and older women and speak out on issues of importance that are being addressed or not being addressed in your community. And these range from feeling unsafe on the street to how to have access to the best information on Medicare sup policies or long-term care policies, what are some job opportunities that to older workers, things like that.
Uh-huh. Thank you. That's helpful. You have most recently been doing work in Russia.
Yes.
Could you talk about... Go ahead.
Yes. I was just in Russia. I returned mid-December. And the work I was doing at that point was in conjunction with a public policy institute looking at social and economic issues facing Russians in general. I was asked to be a resource in looking at some of the policies and ideas that came from this institute and apply them using a gender lens. How do these different issues affect women and girls in Russia? And moving from that to helping parse out how certain policies, whether on the legislative level or lower, could be structured to improve the lives of women and girls or to develop some special pilot projects. And like many countries, Russian people are struggling with poverty. They're struggling with access to good quality health care. They're struggling with housing. I say that Moscow and San Francisco probably compete fairly evenly for the cost of housing. I don't know which is higher, but they're both sort of in the stratosphere. And there have been a lot of changes, obviously, since the move from communism to what was often called perestroika, an open society. And underlying all of the changes just in that kind of transition is the impact of the Putin administration and the issues that we as Americans take more for granted, at least to a certain extent, our right to free speech, our right to free assembly, our right to disagree with government, is really not part of the general dialogue in Russia right now. And that, in turn, affects civil society. The fourth spoke on the wheel, the groups, the NGO groups, that really provide a way of supporting individuals and monitoring government. The Putin administration has pretty much annihilated NGOs at this point.
That's sad. Well, how did you get there?
I've been working in Russia for many years. It's sort of my hobby, I guess you could say. I try to do this work in between the work, this other work that you mentioned in terms of my domestic bio. But I've been working in Russia since the mid-90s, particularly between 1994 and 2001. And my work then was focusing on the change to perestroika, and in conjunction with Russian and American colleagues, trying to create opportunities for women in different communities to come together, identify what was working, what were their barriers for themselves and their children, and to develop a coalition of women in these communities to be able to both articulate strategies and help implement some changes on behalf of women. And during that period of 1994 to 2001, I think I traveled to Russia about 30 times. I was in so many parts of the country, from Siberia to St. Petersburg to Novochikosk, which is right near Chechnya. And over those years, saw some amazing examples of women coming together and advocate successfully, whether it was for improved child care or it was looking at what the health care needs were. Or I remember one time I was speaking, as I often do, on issues around violence against women, and within 2 or 3 months of that meeting, some of the women in the community organized a hotline, and from there, all volunteer, and from there, the issue became more and more important in that local community, and ultimately, there were agreements with the health department, with the police department, in terms of arresting batterers, and it was really quite remarkable. And that repeated itself in very many parts of the country where my colleague and I, colleagues and I, were able to do some, you know, work together with women in those communities.
What is life for a woman? What is life like? What kind of rights do they have?
Are you talking about Russia?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Or in general?
Well, I was thinking of Russia.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that during communism, women had very good access to education and equal to men. And you see that in the fact that the majority of doctors, engineers, or academicians were women during those periods. And the challenge, as it exists all over the world, is that once women dominate a certain sector, that sector is not valued as much, and the pay is much less. So although there were, at least, so many women who were educated as doctors, engineers, professors, their pay was always substantially less than those jobs where men dominated, number one. And women were really expected to bear the brunt of all caregiving, and whether it was child care or taking care of your parents, aunts and uncles, whatever, and to a degree even greater, I think, than many women in the United States, because there were a lot of problems in terms of men's ability to do their work and to be healthy. And there was a substantial amount of alcohol addiction, mostly by men, and that put an even greater burden on the women in the household.
Yes. Let me interrupt you for a moment. You're listening to Joan Kuransky, women's advocate. Well, what is next for you? You seem to be in a point of making a shift.
Well, as you suggested with the description of my current board engagements, I have in the United States primarily been serving on various boards that reflect my interest in addressing anti-poverty issues, women's rights, some international rights, but my work as I'm moving forward, I think, will be continue to be more focused on some of international concerns, in addition to the work that I just described that I've been doing in Russia. I've had the opportunity in the last few years to travel to several countries where the rights of women are emerging as the countries evolve, much like how what I saw when I worked in Russia. In particular, I was in Liberia last year with a group called the American Jewish World Service, and I was able to meet with a number of NGOs there, and the work that women have done in promoting peace in a country that had been torn by civil war for so many years was truly amazing. And in fact, two such leaders in Liberia were awarded the Nobel Nobel Peace Prizes mm-hmm. in 2011.
Lema Boy was one of them.
Yes, and then the current president of Liberia, Alan Sirleaf Johnson.
Yes.
So you have these women who have just done extraordinary things in helping bring their country to peace, and at the same time, you see their NGOs who bring so much enthusiasm and commitment, but are struggling, like all Liberians, with some very difficult challenges, whether it is lack of infrastructure or lack of education. Really, a whole generation of girls and boys became either boy soldiers or young girls who were victims of rape and other kinds of sexual assault, and without any education for a generation. And so how does this country move towards stability and toward the basics that both men and women need to succeed is a challenge. I also recently visited Burma, which is going through a transition. Don't know how permanent it is, but transition from a military, dictatorial, repressive regime to one that's promoting democracy, with elections that took place several years ago and the release of Aung San Suu Kyi, who I'm sure many of your listeners have heard about,
sure.
A woman who represents the reform movement in Burma, Myanmar right now. I had the opportunity to visit, talk to, share experiences and resources with over 12 women's NGOs who were so sophisticated, working on all the issues that you'd anticipate, whether it's promoting women into leadership and political office or helping build skills in terms of vocational education, or fighting violence against women in very strong, innovative ways. And I think where I would like to spend, I'd like to spend more of my time at this point working and sharing with women and girls in parts of the world in addition to the United States.
Mm-hmm. So when you went to Burma, you obviously had people there to connect with. That's how you got there. Is that correct?
Yes. I was really fortunate. I was able to connect with some of the leading activists in the country. Another woman who was in their parliament, who also had spent time in jail, who now is a leading activist on AIDS and women's rights. I met with wonderful organizations, some colorful girls, which organize collaborations with young girls from the different regions in Burma, to another group called Precious Stones, which signified the concept of the more you empower young women, it is like polishing a stone and it becomes precious, which I thought was a very sweet and powerful description at the same time.
Yeah, yes. You know, when we think of these countries and we hear about war and we hear what their leaders are saying, I don't even think of their women. It's like they don't even exist in some way. You know, they're not, what they're doing is not known to the rest of us.
But of course, what women are doing in these countries in particular, it's really the work of the countries. They're the ones who are out trying to get a yield from their small crops. They're the ones who are trying through microenterprise and loans, small loans, to create businesses. The World Bank has in so many ways demonstrated that when you give women these loans, small loans, $100, $300, they are able to make that loan benefit the family much more so than when you give a loan like that to the men. And so the World Bank urges that women, just like our State Department under Hillary Clinton and I believe under the current secretary, believe that women hold a real key to sustaining some of these countries. You can call them countries of the South or developing countries, whatever, but they are the linchpin. And of course, no better example, I think, is what we just mentioned with Liberia. But often the work that women do is unrecognized, and frankly, in some places, it's probably the only safe way to do the work.
Hmm.
But the work is being done.
Yeah, I think about the fighters, the Taliban. Do they all have wives? Do they have families? I mean, we're just given a snippet of what life is really encompasses in those places.
Well, of course, there have been some great books that tell you some, and then every so often you have an experience like you did in India, which is horrific, and probably, from my thinking, not that different than what many women have faced for generations, but it gets to the attention of the media, and some of the information comes forth. I think that the more we can use technology to create bonds among women from different countries, the stronger women in each of their own countries will be. You mentioned my work with the European Union. I've been invited with a colleague to facilitate a meeting of domestic violence programs from throughout the European Union. And you know, I felt privileged to do that. But really, what was most important for the women from, I think it was 26 states, countries, coming together was what they began to build for themselves in creating a voice through the individual countries back through to the European Union and out again on strategies to help reduce, if not eliminate, violence against women in their own areas.
Well, that's wonderful. I too feel I've been reading of here and there of different gatherings of women, international women, and there was one about women coming together about climate change that Jane Goodall and Vandana Shiva and I believe Amy Goodman was there as well. And it was also, there were some Indian women. Do you know the conference I'm talking about? It was not too long.
I did hear about it, but I can't give you the name of it.
Uh-huh.
There are many organizations, and there are several here in California who do fabulous work on behalf of women around the world. You have Global Fund for Women in San Francisco. There is a group from D.C. called Women Thrive Worldwide. There is another group that advocates for human rights who work primarily in the Eastern European and countries and those which are considered newly independent states from Russia. There are many organizations in the United States to support women in other parts of the world. And, of course, the UN has a number of initiatives, as do the Clinton Initiative and Vital Voices. So there are many ways to be involved, even if you're in the United States. Right now there's a big push to get an International Violence Against Women Act passed here in the United States that would help direct funds within the State Department to focus on the needs of women around the world.
That sounds wonderful. You know, our time is running out. If somebody wants to know more about you, they could Google you, I assume.
Yes.
Would that be the best way?
Most likely.
Yes. They'd find a lot. I thank you so much, Joan, and I support and admire your work and wish you the very best with what's ahead for you, perhaps even a move.
Thank you so much. Well, it's wonderful to be among such great women as those in California.
Great.
I'm very inspired.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good night. Thank you.